My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me now and we will explore these topics and so much more with fascinating guests, authors, and experts who will guide us to Destination Unlimited. Regular listeners to Destination Unlimited know of my love for the music of the Moody Blues. In their 1968 release, In Search of the Lost Chord, they presented a spiritual and musical journey to find what they called the lost chord, which turned out to be Om. Graham Edge's final lyric said, in part, "Two notes of the chord is our four scope, but to reach the chord is our life's hope, and to name the chord is important to some, so they give it a word, and the word is Om." On first hearing in 1968, Om was familiar to me, having heard it chanted by older friends practicing meditation, but I was not aware of its Sanskrit origin or the deeply profound and meaningful nature of this ancient language. When I began my yoga practice in the 1980s, I learned and began to study Sanskrit chants, but my appreciation for the language came through the teachings of Vyas Houston, founder of the American Sanskrit Institute. I was privileged to attend some of his lectures where he shared that Sanskrit was the perfect language and, as he said, the mother of all languages. What can some of the foundational lessons of Sanskrit bring to us in today's world? Can an understanding of Sanskrit help us to become more conscious and confident in this often worrisome and confusing world? My guest this week on Destination Unlimited, Sarah Main, says it can. Sarah's whole life has centered around studying, practicing, and teaching higher consciousness and self-awareness. In 1971, at the age of 10, she began on her spiritual journey. She was introduced to mantra meditation and other spiritual disciplines and techniques. By 13, she was studying Sanskrit, and in her early 20s, she was teaching practical self-awareness, philosophy, meditation, and Sanskrit to both children and adults. For decades, she continued to deepen her understanding and experience of consciousness while engaged with the practical world of family and work. A few years ago, seeing a need in the world, she was inspired to take all she has learned and reformulate it into a simple, enjoyable, and practical program of conscious confidence. Since then, Sarah has expanded her conscious confidence program into a full-length book, and she's coached individual clients and has presented her ideas to group seminars and corporate owners. Her website is consciousconfidence.com, and she joins me from Australia to discuss her just-published book, Conscious Confidence, Use the Wisdom of Sanskrit to Find Clarity and Success. Please join me in welcoming to Destination Unlimited, Sarah Main. Good morning in Australia to you, Sarah.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much for having me on.
And thank you for joining us. So please share with our listeners about your path and your very early interest in spirituality.
Well, it really started with my parents. They came out to Australia in the early 1950s after World War II from England, as many Brits did at that time. But they were searching. They were really looking and past just conventional religion that they were brought up with. And they read widely and went to various lectures. And my father went to some philosophy classes, practical philosophy classes, back in the late 1960s. And he came home after the first night, and Mum had stayed home to look after us, me and my siblings. And he said, "This is it. I found this is the knowledge we're looking for." And they pursued that, and I could tell that they were onto something, and I think that's what really lit the flame for me. I was obviously, the fire was ready to be lit, but it was their enthusiasm, their discussions, and then when they started meditating, they were introduced to meditation, I noticed when they sat to meditate, the whole house just had a quietness and a calmness and a vast energy about it. And this was just an ordinary suburban family we still, you know, Dad put on his suit and went to work every day in an office, and Mum stayed at home and cooked and cleaned and looked after us all beautifully. We went to school and did the normal things, rode our bikes after school, etc. And yet there was this other whole realm, and I wanted in on that. So at the age of 10, they said, well, you know, do you want to come to these classes? And I said, yes, please. And I went along, and, you know, my feet didn't touch the ground in the chairs. They were all adult-sized chairs. I didn't care. I sat. I didn't actually understand a lot of what they said. It was, you know, just too complex, most of it. The simple points I got profoundly and deeply, and then when we practiced what wasn't called mindfulness, now these days it's called mindfulness, but we had simple practices every week in the classes of mindfulness and awareness, I just found I just dropped into that straight away. That just spoke to me immediately.
I have to follow up, because at 10 years old, and I know a lot of 10-year-olds in families and so on, mindfulness and spiritual topics are something that are far from most of the average 10-year-old's minds. Do you think that this was something that was carried over for you from a previous lifetime?
Most definitely. It basically, when I had the vocabulary and the understanding to be able to express it and connect with it, it felt like I was essentially picking up from where I left off last time.
Yes. Yep. Now, how did you discover Sanskrit and began your study of the language?
Well, it was through studying philosophy, because it was about getting back to the source wisdom. And, of course, you know, the truth and the universal source wisdom about ourselves and the universe and the creation, the truth of the matter, is expressed so beautifully in the Upanishads and the Bhagavad Gita and so on. And so it started with not necessarily translation, but just starting at the beginning, chanting and sounding the vowel sounds, because that's a purifying activity in itself. We learnt the alphabet and then started on the grammar, and to me it was just magic. I just couldn't get enough of it. So I studied and studied within the philosophy classes and the Sanskrit groups there. And then once I finished high school, I enjoyed music. I was brought up with classical music predominantly. So I started studying music and linguistics at university, and I enjoyed all of that. And yet there was just a nagging sense, and I studied some Latin and so on. And so I, after a while, I pursued the university, and they had a Sanskrit course. This is University of Sydney, and so I enrolled in that, and I just loved it. I had a fantastic teacher, and I did a lot of work. Like, about for 2 1.5-hour classes a week, I was doing about 20 hours preparation. If I didn't do 20 hours of preparation, I felt underprepared. And it was just wonderful. And then I taught it, of course, and and so it's gone on.
I mentioned in our introduction that I attended a lecture by V.S. Houston in the early 1990s, in which he called Sanskrit the perfect language and the mother of all languages. Please share your thoughts on this.
Yes. Well, the word Sanskrita means pure and perfectly formed. So it is the perfectly formed language. And the mother of languages, yes, I say mother of languages rather than the mother of languages, because people these days can get a little bit testy on the detail there of whether there are other languages as well. But certainly, it's just known in the linguistic field that all the Indo-European languages are connected to Sanskrit. I mean, we've been speaking English now for 5 minutes, and directly we have our roots coming straight from Sanskrit in our language. So, yes, and I'm having taught it for many years, and certainly when I taught it to children, and particularly 10 years old and up, you needed to give them some relevance for why they were learning Sanskrit. apart from this is good for you, and which it is. You know, it's an amazing mental training, clears the mind out immediately. But to give them some sort of linguistic history and breadth to the whole situation, they realised the unique position that they were in learning Sanskrit. Let alone, and later on they had the opportunity to learn some Latin as well. So they just found that easy. Latin was a breeze.
I remember V.S. Houston commenting at the time that the study of Sanskrit was his yoga. He had said that he had gone to a guru and other people had been practicing various forms of hatha yoga. Some people have practiced forms of the yoga of devotion, but his yoga was the Sanskrit language.
Yeah, I know people in who would say the same thing. They have dedicated their life to teaching Sanskrit and have developed, really for children, not exclusively, but a lot of them, they have done huge amounts of work and produced the most beautiful textbooks and course for children and for and any adult could learn it as well. And yes, I can understand that. Anything you give your attention to is a form of meditation. So Sanskrit certainly can be that.
And I remember him also talking about the purity of the grammar and the formation. For example, we talk about the Om. It starts down in the heart chakra, or actually down in the stomach area, down in the solar plexus, and works its way up and out.
Yes, absolutely. That's all there with the para pashyanti madhyamawe kari. That's the whole system of speech. And that's all covered in Sanskrit. But it is pure and it purifies. And that's the magnificent thing about it.
My guest is Sarah Main. She's the author of the new book, Conscious Confidence. Use the wisdom of Sanskrit to find clarity and success. We'll be back with more of Sarah after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of Om Times Magazine's flagship radio show, What is Going Om? My passion is sifting through information, research, and innovations from New Thought teachers, speakers, and researchers pushing back the boundaries of what we know about life, energy, metaphysics, and the universe. I love shifting perceptions about who we are, why we're here, and how quickly impossible becomes normal when we open our minds, expand our awareness, and accept that the only limits that exist are those we place upon ourselves. So if you're the kind of forward-thinking, eager investigator of what lies beyond the current reality that most perceive, why not make a date to come play with me in the field of possibilities at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time every Thursday, and together we can discover what's really going on.
So I'm a cat, and I just moved in with this new human, and she's got this little toy she's always playing with all day long. Tap, 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 bloop, bloop. She can't put it down. There it is. Oh, and get this. She even talks to it. Last week she asked it for Chinese, and guess what? Egg rolls showed up like magic. Humans have cool toys.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this week is Sarah Main. She's the author of the new book, Conscious Confidence. Use the wisdom of Sanskrit to find clarity and success. Sarah, how is Sanskrit the language of the universe?
Oh, well, that's such a wonderful question. I love it. Well, of course, it's connected to all the languages, the Indo-European languages, for one. So that's just on a linguistic level. But the system of the way Sanskrit is put together, where the language, the vocabulary is derived from verbal roots, little monosyllabic sounds that are verbal roots. Now, the key is in the verb, and if you go back to your elementary school, primary school grammar lessons, in English, a verb is a doing word, it's an action, it's an activity, it's not a thing, it's not an object, it's not a concept, it's an action, it's energy. And it's phenomenal that you have a language where the core of the whole language is based in energy. And if you take that as being the energy of creation, because everything is a form of energy, it's an expression. Sanskrit is an expression, a pure and perfectly formed expression of the energy, the very energy of creation of the universe. And so to come back to the meaning of a word in Sanskrit, it's an experiential meaning. In the act of something, you will discover the meaning. It's not an object or a concept. So in English, we generally speaking, our sense of meaning is via a concept. We think table, it's a thing, rather than something that is in the act of tabling, you know. And the act of tabling, what does that mean? Well, okay, something that supports, you can put things on, let's say, I'm using a very basic example. But it's in the act of something is the meaning is found. And that turns the whole thing on its head. And in that way, Sanskrit reflects the very activity of creation in all its minute and precise and beautiful detail.
I saw a piece by someone who basically said that the algorithms of today's digital computer language would not be possible without Sanskrit.
Yeah, I'm not one to be able to explain that. But when mathematics transcends the normal, you know, computational level that we know from school, but going to, you know, school, but there's a beauty and an artistry and a language of mathematics, and Sanskrit absolutely is up playing at that level as well and beyond, of course.
Now, how is Sanskrit of practical relevance today?
Well, going back to what I was talking about, where meaning in Sanskrit, the meaning is known at an experiential level rather than a conceptual level. What I've done in the book, for example, is take some key concepts and key ideas, like, for example, values. Everyone talks about values, your core values, or attitude, or being conscious. These words are around, but what does that mean? And you can see how people live is based on the meaning and generally the subconscious meaning that they have in their mind and their heart. It's unknown, it's subconscious. And what I did was go back to the Sanskrit. What does the Sanskrit say about it? Let's get back to some fundamental, clear, precise, pure and perfectly formed wisdom. Let's uncover that and use that as the basis for then how we live our life. So you don't have to go and study Sanskrit for years and learn a lot of declensions and things like that and conjugations. You can if you like, and it's fantastic. I can recommend it. But in terms of just living everyday life, let's go back and clarify the very definitions and meanings we have for some fairly fundamental principles. We need to go back beyond a good English dictionary like Webster's or the Oxford. We need to get back to Sanskrit because Sanskrit will tell us what we need to do. It's in the action of something that we'll understand. And generally speaking, I find when I present this, people go, and it's those aha moments that are so exciting because immediately the understanding is taken out of the usual boundaries that it lives in. And by that very fact, someone's life has changed in that moment, because there's been that aha moment, as we say.
I recently read that Sanskrit is now being taught in British schools with amazing results. Do you think this curriculum should be adopted in other countries?
Oh, absolutely. I know some of the people I was speaking about who have dedicated their life to teaching Sanskrit. It's there in the UK, in London, and their work is phenomenal. All I can just, I bow to them, namaste to them. It's unbelievable, the work they're doing, and it is magnificent and the effect is incredible. And in fact, the school that I taught at in Sydney, I went to London and got the, this was many years ago, I got the early curriculum that they were developing. And in fact, before they handed it over to me, I think it's because they, you know, I'm an Australian, and you know, British people have ideas of Australian accents and so on. I had to actually do a pronunciation test for them before they handed the material over to me to make sure I wouldn't ruin it. Anyway, I passed the test. Phew! And the fellow who was listening to me and asking me things, he said, I think your Sanskrit pronunciation is better than your English.
That's funny.
I had to laugh. And so it's very, and he handed me the material, and I took it back to Sydney, and it's simple material, so I had enough Sanskrit to know what it was. And then I started training our teachers and developed, and I worked at developing the Sanskrit curriculum. Of course, it's moved on considerably, but that was 25 years ago. So it is around in schools. Unfortunately, in some schools, it wasn't. In the school I taught at, it was a core curriculum subject, so everyone had to learn it. Mm. And the children, the more advanced children, the older children to this day, do an 11-plus Cambridge-based international Sanskrit exam. You know, there are schools that do it in parts, but it's seen as a sort of advanced thing for gifted and talented students. And that's a shame, because every child can benefit from it. You just need to pitch it, you know, as a starting point so that they can take it on.
Another article that I read actually said that the study of Sanskrit is beneficial for memory and logic in the brain.
Oh, absolutely. So taking some very simple prayer or mantra or something and just practicing the sounds, and so it's beautiful and clear and well articulated, and then just a sevenfold repetition is the traditional way of learning through the oral tradition, is repeating something seven times, and then you move on to the next thing and repeat that seven times, and that's sufficient for it to go into the mind and learn by heart. People unfortunately call that just sort of rote learning, but it isn't. If it's done consciously, it goes into the heart, and you need to have these core things in your heart. And the sevenfold repetition is phenomenally powerful, and it's how the sages work.
What's the significance of seven? Is there a significance of seven there?
I'm not entirely sure. I mean, if you look at the seven steps of transformation, as in the Yoga Vasishta of Shubhechcha, Suvicharana, etc., that's in my book, and there are other books on it. There is a sevenfold process from individual to universal, and it also covers the sevenfold stages of an action. If you decide you wanted to make a chair, it goes in seven steps. There's seven. The octave is made up of seven, and then the final one is the octave up to the do of the next step. So one could possibly assume there's some connections there.
What are some of the most important and memorable things you learned from your spiritual teachers?
Oh, wow. That's a wonderful question. That I am, that you are, we are all one, universal expressions of universal consciousness is one. Number two, I was taught as a matter of discipline to practice something. For example, it was said, as a matter of discipline, see each of your students every day as the universal consciousness, the universal self. And that is an unbelievable thing to be told to practice, to be offered as a practice, as a matter of discipline, because that takes away whether you feel like it or not that day. Because trust me, there are days, certainly as a teacher, and I'm sure in any other job, where you really don't feel like it. You know, you're tired. Ooh, there's a lot of work to do. And there are some children, some days where, you know, their behavior, especially young children, they're challenging and it's difficult. And you don't see them as they seem anything but the universal consciousness, which is Satchitananda, truth, knowledge, and bliss. And yet, as a matter of discipline, you do that. So it takes you out of all that individual stuff. And it is so freeing. That's real discipline, where you can move freely. And how beautiful and how blessed is that? And I found that wonderful every single day to connect with each child and see them and connect with them as universal consciousness. And then, you know, if their behavior wasn't good, I dealt with the behavior. But it was from the basis of consciousness rather than a naughty kid.
Absolutely. And it also, I think it generates greater compassion.
Oh, yeah. Compassion and respect on both sides, you know.
Yeah. Definitely. I am you and you are me and we are one.
Exactly. Yeah.
My guest is Sarah Main. She's the author of the new book, Conscious Confidence, Use the Wisdom of Sanskrit to Find Clarity and Success. Sarah, please tell our listeners where they can find out more about you, get your book, and also your website.
Well, you can find out more about me and the book at my website, which is consciousconfidence.com. That's consciousconfidence.com. And there's links there to Amazon, Barnes & Noble for the book, and it's available as a hard copy book, soft paperback, and also as an ebook, and on very soon it's coming out as an audio book. So that'll be available very soon. And you can also see the work that I do, and there's lots of other material. There's magazine articles and things to read as well, which fills out the understanding of how I work and how not to be put off by Sanskrit. Don't be scared by it.
Absolutely. My guest is Sarah Main. We're talking about conscious confidence. We'll be back with more of Sarah after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
This is OTRFM, part of the iOM Radio Network.
Humanity Healing International is a small nonprofit with a big dream. Since 2007, HHI has been working tirelessly to bring help to communities with little or no hope. Our projects are not broad mandates, nor are they overnight solutions, but they bring the reassurance that no one is alone and that someone cares. To learn more, please visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Connect at omtimes.com. Om Times, creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
Adopt US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the Lingo.
GOAT, G-O-A-T, acronym, stands for Greatest of All Time. As in, spaghetti sandwiches for dinner? They're my fave. Dad, you're the GOAT.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this week is Sarah Main. We're talking about her new book, Conscious Confidence, Use the Wisdom of Sanskrit to Find Clarity and Success. Sarah, what's your take on meditation, self-awareness, and mindfulness?
Well, meditation. I was introduced to meditation at the age of 10, so it's just part of life for me. It's like breathing. I don't know a time when I didn't have meditation in my life. I think it's the absolute basis. All the spiritual teachers worth their salt, and anyone who has meditated, will say that meditation is the master key, the master key that opens all doors. So meditation is an absolute foundation and fundamental. It takes care of the whole person, the body, mind, heart, and spirit. And it is the key to helping us find alignment and balance, and particularly in this day and age where it can be very confusing and disjointed, and we're seeing the results of that, the disconnect between mind and heart and with our fundamental self is for all to see. And technology is not helping. I don't want to sort of just badmouth technology, but it's not helping. It's sort of accelerating that disconnect a bit. The mindfulness and self-awareness just go hand in hand with the meditation. It's fundamental. Anything that can raise our self-awareness is a good thing. Raise the level of consciousness, raise our sights, raise our vision. And the mindfulness practices are so helpful, just to be simply aware of what we're doing in the present moment.
And I must ask, who is that lovely creature chanting behind you just now?
That is a sulfur-crested cockatoo, and there are lots of them in Australia. They're those big white birds that have the yellow crest on their head, if you look, Google that up. And we have lots of them around here, and they screech and squawk.
As far as I'm concerned, he was chanting, and it was beautiful, so thank you for
there
sharing.
There we go. Oh, yes, I must remember, that's what he's doing, he's chanting. That's before they try and dig up things and eat things.
That's right. Now, what are some of the key spiritual principles that you've applied in your teaching career?
Number one, see every student every day as the Supreme Self. That's number one. Number two, fall still, remember who you are, and then give full attention to the matter in hand. And that alone, fall still, fall deeply still, remember who you are, and then give full attention to the matter in hand. That alone takes you through everything. Because the knowledge that when you give full attention to the matter in hand from that perspective, the knowledge that is present there is precise, exactly what is required. And that just carried me and many of my fellow colleagues, staff members, through, because, you know, there's not always an immediate answer to a situation, be it with a child or a learning issue or a behavioural issue or what to do next. Adopting that practice alone, the universal knowledge shines and you can carry that forward.
Absolutely. In your executive coaching work, what are the main issues you find that people need help with?
Lack of clarity moving forward, and a lack of some fundamental knowledge about themselves, and that leads to a lack of certainty about how to move forward, particularly if the client wants to step into a new field. It could be a whole new career or a new aspect of it, of their existing career, or just a general dissatisfaction with what they're doing, so finding a deeper meaning and purpose in what they're doing to re-inspire them. And overcoming any resistance to stepping out of any comfort zone, that needs usually some support to do that. They're some of the really key things. And just a safe sounding board to really speak what's in their heart.
One of the things that I've found after nearly 42 years in the industry that I perform in my day job is passing on my accumulated knowledge to the young folks who are coming on after me. And it's such a joy to do that.
Yeah, I agree.
And I think all executives should project themselves into that position, that when they get into a position of wisdom and seniority in later years prior to retirement, that they should pass on what they've learned with those who are coming after them. And I think that's a...
Yes, and it's necessary.
Absolutely. It's it's so essential to keep that flow of information going, because that's stuff that you can't give, you can't teach that. It's just experience that has to be shared.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Now, in your book, you offer wonderful stories and allegories to help us relate to many of the concepts you share. And one of my favorites is the one you call the camel driver. Please share with our listeners the essence of this and how it may apply to our lives.
That's a great story. It's in the chapter on being conscious and versus being unconscious. And the story is there's a camel driver and he's very good, and people hire the camels to carry their wares from one market to another. And this camel driver takes on a young apprentice and trains him. And then he says, all right, well, after a while, he says, what questions do you have about the camel driving business? And the young apprentice says, I've noted. They get a new camel, and he says, I've noticed you had a new camel, and you train it by tying a rope at night. You tie a rope around its neck to tether it, and then you pass your hand around the neck, imitating the act of the rope. And you do that for a while, and then at a certain point you stop and you no longer use the rope. You just pass your hand around imitating the act of the rope. And the camel is essentially standing there free, and it could at any moment walk off at night completely free. And yet your camels don't, whereas I've seen when we're on camel trips on the road, other camel owners, other camel drivers, they tie up their camels with ropes every night, but you don't. You just pass your hand around the neck, imitating the action of the rope, and that is sufficient. And that story indicates exactly what we do in terms of being unconscious. We think ourselves into being bound. We're actually free, like those camels standing there at night, untethered by actual ropes, but they think they're bound because they've been taught to think they're bound. And we do that to ourselves with the repetitive limiting ideas we have of ourselves that are just rattling through our heads all day, every day, as we're going about our business. We're just reminding ourselves again and again of the false notion that we are limited, and that is unconscious. And in order to be free, we need to become more conscious. We need to raise our level of awareness.
Absolutely.
And that story is a very simple illustration. Children get it immediately.
I love that story. We seem to be living in a world of judgment, criticism, and divisiveness. I remember a Buddhist allegory about judgment that had a valuable lesson. It was the story of a Zen master and a new apprentice who were walking along a road, and they were both tired and decided that it was time to take a nap. And when the apprentice awoke from his nap, he looked over and he saw his master looking into a mirror. And he walked over and said, Master, I thought you were a man of mastery and perfection, and yet you're looking into a mirror. You're vain. You're showing vanity. And the Zen master smiled, and he looked at his apprentice and said, My son, he said, when I look into this mirror, I see the source of all of my questions, confusion, and problems, and also the source of all of my answers. And that's how he answered his student.
Wow.
Please share with our listeners the essence of how this and how it may apply to our lives, this concept of judgment, because we're so quick to judge and criticize others.
Well, yes. if we look out and see some apparent imperfection and then take the action of judging and criticizing, the fact of whatever we see is a reflection of what's within us. And so often it's just an out projection of something that we don't see as perfect within ourselves. And we have a concept of perfection that we're measuring it against. That said, if we see some perfection, really the thing is to look within. And that's not to criticize ourselves. That's to use it like that beautiful story. Use it as a mirror, to hold a mirror up to nature, as Shakespeare said. And just see what we need to actually work on within ourselves. These simple concepts, I mean, I've taught this to children and they get it. It's not hard. But unfortunately, the judgment and the criticism, there's a certain energy and a taste, and people get a taste for this. And it's a nastiness and a meanness, certainly, and a divisiveness, and it creates huge unhappiness and problems. But people have a taste, it's literally like a taste in their mouth for that. And you need to change the taste, have a taste for praise, have a taste for uplifting. And one simple way of getting past that is in the chapter on uniting in the book, is it's a simple practice of seeing the unifying factor underlying two or many different things. For example, simple apple, orange, the underlying unifying principle is fruit, just simple. Hat, bag, coat, underlines clothing, for example, or hat and coat, clothing. Just take very simple things like that and train the mind to just see the underlying unifying factor. And, you know, and if you start doing that, it just means that when your senses perceive all this difference, which you then stay at the level of and judge, you actually go beyond that, you transcend that to what's underlying. And that's not some hugely deep sort of weird spiritual practice. It's very simple, and it's very important in training the mind and the reason to do that, to find the underlying unifying principle.
And in seeing each other as ourselves, we learn compassion, and through compassion, we learn love. My guest is Sarah Main. She's the author of Conscious Competence, Use the Wisdom of Sanskrit to Find Clarity and Success. We'll be back with more of Sarah after these words on the OM Times Radio Network.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Looking for inspiration?
Want to be inspired?
Not sure where to go?
Find Mark and Kim every Wednesdays at 3 p.m. Eastern on Inspired Living.
Topics will elevate consciousness and range from metaphysics to the human and social experience and all things spiritual.
Welcome to an inspired community that offers support, encouragement, and new ways of thinking. You are the inspired and the inspiration.
Change and growth are part of natural life, and also part of your spiritual life. Everyone needs support and guidance, especially during life passages. Upgrade yourself with the OM Times Experts program. With OM Times Experts, you have access to the best intuitive coaches, spiritual teachers, counselors, astrologists, and oracles. Our team was carefully selected so you can trust. Find out more at experts.omtimes.com.
What does Meals on Wheels do? They deliver meals and smiles to homebound seniors. But Meals on Wheels does something else. They turn a volunteer's lunch break into a meaningful experience.
As small and as simple as the relationship is between a volunteer and a client of Meals on Wheels, it's really so impactful. I never thought that 5 minutes could make so much difference in the lives of two people, but it has.
Drop off a warm meal and get more than you expect. Volunteer at AmericaLet'sDoLunch.org. That's AmericaLet'sDoLunch.org. Brought to you by Meals on Wheels America and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Bill Maher. I can find humor in almost anything, but one thing I never laugh about is cruelty to animals. If you don't get the joke either, write People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, 501 Front Street, Norfolk, Virginia, 23510.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this week is Sarah Main. She's the author of Conscious Confidence, Use the Wisdom of Sanskrit to Find Clarity and Success. Sarah, what is conscious confidence, and how does it differ from unconscious confidence?
Well, conscious confidence arises from that fundamental connection with yourself. It's a self-assurance. It shows itself as resilience, certainly. There's a calmness and a strength to it. conscious confidence has a bond of hope, confidence, and trust in it. It has belief. It has calm faith. It's united. It's strong. It's focused. It's all those qualities. It's like the roots that go deep into the earth of a great tree. The great tree stands tall and proud. That's the bit we can see, and that can withstand storms and tempests and not fall over and can thrive. Well, those roots down into the deep earth, that's the roots of conscious confidence.
And unconscious confidence.
And unconscious confidence is that confidence that we think is either we're born with it, you know, that person's lucky, they seem confident, I'm not confident. So you see that outward show of confidence. And also confidence that's dependent on external circumstances being a particular way for you to feel confident. And there's certainly an element of confidence that has its place every day where we have a familiarity with something so we can move easily within that field or perform that task. But behavior where it's, you know, brash and someone who's out there, sometimes that is just completely unconscious sort of personality and derived from a certain familiarity in a field, you know, whether it's a performer on stage or whatever it is. But sometimes, you know, that behavior typically can fall apart when something unexpected and challenging appears.
Mm-hmm.
The confidence I'm talking about comes from a fundamental connection with yourself. It's not dependent on externals.
Mm. Now, how did you develop your Conscious Confidence FUSE FUSE program, and what does FUSE FUSE stand for?
Okay. How I developed it was the roots of it. It goes back to when a lot happened when I was 10. I started.
Obviously.
Do you want the historical? There's a historical element to this.
Go ahead, please.
Do you want the long story? The historical.
Please go ahead. Go. This is your show.
When I was 10, I started learning the piano. My mother organized. She was working for someone and doing part-time secretarial work, and this chap's daughter was a harpist, training as a harpist, who's a very eminent Australian harpist to this day. And she was still studying at the Conservatorium of Music in Sydney, and I was learning the piano from her, and I saw this beautiful harp in the corner, and she saw me looking at it. She said, "Do you want to hear it?" And I said, "Yes, please." And she just played a few arpeggios, and that was just an instant. I fell deeply in love with the sound of the harp and harbored this desire to learn the harp, which then fast forward to only a few years ago, my wonderful husband, we'd finished teaching after 30 years, and he said, "I'm going to take up Spanish lessons again," because I used to be able to speak Spanish, "but I'm not going to do that unless you start harp lessons, because you've been talking about it for as long as we've been together," which is over 30 years.
Wonderful.
So that was I had to find a teacher, and I did all of that. And my teacher, so I'd only been learning about 8 months or so, like a real beginner, and my teacher was running a harp workshop, and she said, "Come along, even though you're a beginner, doesn't matter, come along." So I go along for the weekend, and one of the sessions was run by a psychologist on dealing with performance anxiety for musicians. And so I'm in this room with like 30 harpists who are like real harpists. I'm a beginner. And they're talking openly and freely about all the issues around performance anxiety. And this workshop, in fact, was so popular, my harp teacher had to run it a second time that day for all these other musicians like flautists and violinists who wanted to have time with this psychologist. So anyway, they're talking about how it's commonplace for musicians to take medication to deal with performance anxiety these days. I was astonished. I've never heard of this. And it really raised an interest in me, and the psychologist did talk about mindfulness practices, but he wasn't skilled in any of that sort of thing. He was just repeating what he'd read. And I thought, well, that's certainly my wheelhouse. There must be a way of utilizing this in this area of performance anxiety. So I started looking into it and read a lot of, you know, about fight, flight and so on and so forth. I knew a bit about it, but I really went into it. And then I thought, what is happening when you are fundamentally confident? And that was the question that started it. Mm. After all of this stuff about performance anxiety and how can you utilize mindfulness and presence, I thought, what is happening when you are confident? And when I asked that question, it was just like a light went on. Go and look at the Sanskrit, because Sanskrit is based in these verbal roots. It tells you what is happening. That's where the meaning is. And so I got out all my Sanskrit dictionaries and I started looking it up and I discovered 12 words for confidence in Sanskrit. And I went back to all the derivations and the etymology, back to Panini, the Sanskrit scholar and grammarian and sage. And as I started looking at all of this, and I had months of research and pages of stuff, it was fantastic. I just loved it. And then I laid it all out on the dining room table and I said to my husband, honey, what am I looking? There's something here. What am I looking at? I can feel it. There's something here. It's telling me. And he said, right, let's start grouping them. And as soon as he said that, I could immediately see the F-U-S-E. They grouped into four like energies. One was focusing. One was uniting. One was simplifying. One was energizing. They're distinct characteristics. And that's where the FUSE program came from. And that's how I came to into all of this.
And how do you apply the FUSE principle?
Well, focusing, uniting, simplifying, energizing, when I looked at that, the foundations of that were core values and attitude, and I looked up the Sanskrit, went into the Sanskrit about values and about attitude. And applying it, when you are confident, when you're just connected with yourself, one way of describing it is like there is this connection, and it has these characteristics of being focused, of being united, you're not divided. There's a simplifying element, is letting go of unnecessary things. So there's a clarity there. And then there's an energy there of just taking clear, dynamic, creative action that's purposeful and uplifting. And so the application really with the FUSE principle, the FUSE program, is you can take each one and practice them. And in the book, I have practices for each of these stages of the FUSE program so that you can come to grips and get a feel for it. Or you can just simply be in the present moment. You will discover the FUSE program in its entirety, the essence of it, in that connection with yourself. But my experience is people need to start with what's important, their core values, and explore that, then work on their attitude, and then practice focusing, uniting, simplifying, and energizing. And they're the fourfold energies of conscious confidence.
You share many wonderful and practical techniques and exercises in conscious confidence. One of them that I really liked is 139. Please share with our listeners 139.
139 is a principle I was introduced to in relation to measure and balance, bringing about the alignment of body, mind, heart, and spirit. And if we take a whole person is made up of a physical body, a mental body, an emotional body, and a spiritual body, if you take what's needed for the physical body, which is food, exercise, and rest, then by extension, the mental body needs food, exercise, and rest. The emotional body needs food, exercise, and rest, and so does the spiritual body, food, exercise, and rest each day. So what is good food, exercise, and rest? Well, physical body, there's tons of for that, but for the mental, emotional, and spiritual bodies. And there's a measure to it. It's based in santulana to do with balance. And there's a measure. And the essence of measure is knowing when to stop. Enough of one thing and move on to the next thing. Not too much, not too little. And you need to be conscious and aware and present to know when to stop something and move on to the next. And 139 refers to 1 hour per day of meditation, And that can be broken up in different ways. It can be just one single hour of meditation, but 1 hour in total of meditation, 3 hours of uplifting, restful mental activity, 3 hours a day of uplifting, enjoyable, restful mental activity, and that rests the heart as well, and then 9 hours of work, and then the rest of the time is on the daily business of, you know, washing and cooking and cleaning. So that's the 1-3-9. Meditation 1, 3, restful mental activity, and 9 is the work. And as one lady said to me recently, she said, I'm good on the 1 and I'm good on the 9, but it's that 3. I'm not good on the 3. And that's the thing. That's where most of our stresses and strains in daily life, we don't actually give proper nourishment and rest and exercise for the mental and emotional part of our being. It's starving most of the time. Yeah. And that's, you know, study and art and beauty and nature and those sorts of things. We don't do enough of that.
And those are one, that is one of the wonderful exercises and practices that Sarah lists in her book, Conscious Confidence, Use the Wisdom of Sanskrit to Find Clarity and Success. Sarah, one more time, please tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about you and this amazing work.
Well, they can get my book at Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble. And if you're in Australia, booktopia.com.au has the book. But go to my website, consciousconfidence.com. That's consciousconfidence.com. And all the links are there through to Amazon, Barnes & Noble and so on to get the book. It's available in paperback and in ebook. And the audio book is coming out in a very few short days, which I'm very excited about. And you can see on my website the work that I do, and there's lots of other information and links to other podcasts and a blog.
Sarah, on behalf of my listeners and everyone else, namaste. Thank you so much for this wonderful work.
Namaste, Shubhamastu. Thank you so much. It's just been a delight and a pleasure and a privilege to speak with you.
And thank you for joining us on Destination Unlimited. I'm Victor, the Voice Furman. Have a wonderful week.